Shower, she squeezes her spots, brushes her teeth, shoots a deodorant spray up her twat. It's getting her hot. She's just 24 and she
shove it right in.
And pull it right out. Woo! And shove it in again.
Thank you.
Well, everybody started jamming. Even the static, the air escaping from our mouths got involved. Let me just check that, though. This. Time to start the Zappa Hour Plus. Plus means the other hours that we have to do to get into it. So I will unmute Bert and Roxy. Are you there, Bert?
No, this is me, fellows.
What's your name? Is that Roxy?
Roxy, Queen of Horniness.
Getting in the zap mood, and Bert. Maybe that's not Bert. Is this Bert? Which one are you, Bert?
I'm here.
Okay, good. All right, some business. On the chat line, somebody calling themselves 0.94. They don't have a name, but they have a number. I thought that was part of Dave's posting, so I thought Dave was asking for shove it right in, but it was 0.94. And this 0.94 seems to be a knowledgeable Zappa guy because he named the second song I played Heavy Duty Judy, which Carolyn came over and said, have I ever heard this before? And I don't think she has. So 0.94 knows Zappa, but we don't know who he or she is. Alyssa says, Bob's live remix Zappa Hour Plus begins. That's right, Alyssa. And Alyssa... She ran over a couple hours ago to see Eugene Chadbourne. You probably didn't, you two wouldn't have heard me talk about him. He was a guy who, a few years ago before Jimmy Carblack died, he played and hung out with Jimmy Carblack, the Indian of the group. That was the term in the Mother's Invention in the 60s. Jimmy Carblack was a pretty neat guy. And Eugene Chadbourne, I attended a small performance he gave with the CKLN gang in 92 after I'd left CKLN, and they wondered why I was there. How could I know about Eugene Chadbourne? I actually didn't know much about him, heard a bit about him, and I'm sitting in the back, and then he, in the middle of the concert, he introduces a song, but he dedicates it to J.R. Bob Dobbs. Well, that certainly shocked the young people. They all swirled around and looked at me and wondered, what did I have to do with this guy? So that worked. That was great. And build up my mystery profile. And let's see. Ben Watson makes a lot out of Eugene Chadbourne. He plays an electric rake. So Alyssa, she said a couple hours ago, yay, L-Truth. Now what'd she say? She says... Like we got 9:46, so what time is it? 10? Oh, maybe, yeah. So she, a few hours ago, she just posted this. She said, hi, guys, I'm back. Oh, no, that's not the first statement. She says, I have to scroll down here, find it. Haven't got it here. Oh, Alyssa, there it is. So, she says, hey, all. Bob, I'm seeing Eugene Chadbourne tonight in Ventura, California. And Wiki says he was influenced by the Mother's Invention and Captain Beefheart. You familiar with him? I've never heard of him, but checking it out live tonight. So she goes to it and returns and says, she says, Hi, guys, I'm back. And Eugene Chadbourne was pretty fantastic. Then she says, ha ha. Well, someone says, Alyssa, that was the fastest concert ever, says L Truth. And she says, ha ha, he played for 50 minutes at the local record store in Ventura, California. We biked home, easy breezy. Yeah, he seems to play on the smaller place, smaller venues. He's got quite a big reputation, but I don't think he got into the corporate level much. She said, Alyssa says, I talked to him a bit about playing with Jimmy Carl Black, but he was packing up and we didn't go too deep on stuff. And she then cheers L Truth and she says, excited for that. What did L Truth say? Oh, about L Truth predicted what I was going to play tonight. Then she says, P.S., evidently some Air Force base in Italy where Chadbourne hung out with Jimmy Carl Black accidentally flew a plane into a ski lift. Eek! Anyways, Chadbourne's lyrics were killer. There will be a YouTube of it, and I'll post it on Dupes or something. Then, did she say anything else? Then she says, Bob's live remix Zappa Hour Plus begins. And then Jean says, Alyssa, you have a magnificent existence traveling all over the country visiting friends. Okay. Yes, Alyssa is a musician. She has a big band from the jazz school, you know, basically 30s and 40s stuff. She's about 105 years old. She's been playing for years. And she looks like she's 22. But that's what happens when you hang out with Bob. All these parallel worlders get attracted to you, and they drop in and... He ain't seen nothing yet. Dave was totally fooled. He doesn't know. Dave Neufeld. She visited Dave Neufeld a couple of weeks ago. Dave had no clue she was 105, and we didn't tell him. But there it is, Dave. Now you know. So what we have tonight, guys and girls and gals and lads and lasses, is I was talking about some themes that Roxy was wanting to do tonight. And then I said, well, I'm going to check out. I had a pretty interesting conversation with Zappa and Joyce and Lewis at one point. Let me find that. So I was listening to it, and I said, holy damn, theirs is an anachrony or synchronicity. They talk about what Roxy wants to talk about. So this would be about 40, 45 minutes, I think. Are you guys ready to hear that, Roxy, or will you do some talking about other matters first?
No, it's perfect like that. I had this week, yeah. I had the words universal spin in my head all the time, so that's why somehow this thing showed up.
Well, wait till you were picking up on this, because you'll be surprised. Listen closely, you'll hear the themes right there, even the words. So, Bert, anything you want to say from hangover from last week or any themes before we put on the recording?
Is this recording including Zappa with Wyndham Lewis?
Yes. It's
at all?
I did a mashup. I got them all together in one room, an Astor room. McLuhan, Zappa, Garrett Dean, Tim Carey. It's awesome. This is an incredible scenario. And go ahead.
No, from last week, just when you were going over them or us, I a whole week I was just thinking about that, and then I just kept thinking of Wyndham Lewis. You know, I wanted to know if Zappa knew anything about Wyndham Lewis, so I'll get some answers.
No, you know, as far as I know, Zappa did not know much about Wyndham Lewis, but Captain Beefheart did. One of his band members or his wife, I'm not sure which, turned him on to Captain Beefheart. It might have been Gary, forget his last name, he was a very good guitarist in the later Captain Beefheart Magic Band, Gary somebody. He, I think, read Apes of God, a huge book, to Beefheart while they were on tour, or his wife did, I'm not sure which, but I think Gary Lucas. And Beefheart was amazed, and there's a photograph of Beefheart in Manchester, England, attending a gallery show of Wyndham Lewis paintings, a revival of Lewis about 1980. So here's Don, who Wyndham Lewis, that famous picture of him in the studio, I don't know, in the teens, he looks exactly like Beefheart. He and Beefheart look a lot alike, around the same age. And Zappa looks more like Joyce, or has this Joycean aspect. So you had the musical replay of the Vortices when you come into Beefheart and Zappa, which is pretty nice. Acoustic space, odd all tactile replay in the 60s of what went on in the 20s. Okay, so it's pretty interesting. I will now set it up, start it at the right point. So you and Roxy can talk for a second among yourselves while I set this up. You can.
Yeah. Hey, I have a question for Roxanne.
No, wait. Okay, Roxanne. Bert. Yeah. Hey, Bert. You said you were thinking about it all week. What were you thinking about all week? Wyndham Lewis or
just how,
from last week?
No, actually, just thinking about how Zappa set up this demo us and how it waves into plays. Music tied in and a book, how he just wove all this tightly woven in together. And it's like it just blew me away. So I was just thinking, it seems to me it was like a Wyndham Lewis influence of trying to create a point, but he used all the different mediums.
Media. When you say mediums plural, you say media, M-E-D-I-A.
Yeah. I'm just saying he used
mediums,
the book.
I think artists say mediums plural when they're talking about the medium of paint. But when you're talking about communication technology, you say media. Yeah, anyways, yes, okay. Now that is discussed a bit. This is what's incredible, what you guys were thinking about. Turned out that on September 9th, 1997, a day after LaRouche's birthday, September 8th, the day I did a session with the Evergreens on September 8th, and then went back on September 9th in Toronto, 1997, and we're going to hear the first of the two I did on that day. So we're getting near the end of my career with the Evergreens in 1997. We still got two more years, but later stuff, maybe more advanced interrogation of the Evergreens. I was more familiar with them, understood them better. So let me, okay, now you can, while I set up the recording, go ahead and say something to Roxy, Bert.
Roxanne, what do you think of Bob's DJing? I wanted to know, what do you think? What affects Bob's DJing?
Well, Bob is a product of tactile space. And we're going to talk about that because one of the developments I see in music is that because there is no more linear, the linear that dominated the visual space, there are other types of controllers coming in which people don't play anymore. They sort of dance to trigger events. So we are not, the main controller since Bach was the keyboard. And, for example, Buchla started developing controllers using the infrared technology, like your remote controls of TV, so that you can control without wires an instrument, a device. And I see the technology, the controllers as a type of interface. We want to interface with the non-physical, and that was what Bach was trying to do, and all the scientists trying to understand the power of God and the laws of nature. And now that we're going to see where things are not linear, but they're more like a vortex. People are not playing anymore like lines of rhythm or melodies. They trigger many things with their bodies, for example, like textures or a whole song or sequence. And it's like dancing. And you have different regions in space, and you assign whatever you want this in that area to be triggered when you touch that area. You can also program, for example, dynamics. If I go up, this is going to be louder or faster or things like that. And there are, like, for example, laptop orchestras and people playing with their cell phones, making music, being far away from each other.
Laptop and, orchestras?
Yes. Yes. There is a laptop orchestra, for example, in the Stanford University. They have developed very interesting technologies. And the conductor can, for example, just write in a screen all the different commands, like play louder or trigger sequence number one or whatever he's conducting like that. And the people seem to be dancing or writing in their computers. And this type of vortex, I mean, we are not doing this linear anymore, is what Bob is doing with his DJing. He has this vortex of all types of music because that's the way it is. There is no real linear time. Everything is happening at once. And there are all these things going on that seem to be unrelated, but in a way everything is related. And that was also the idea of Barrés when he was composing, that Zappa liked so much. And Zappa went to develop also this type of style of mixing all types of music, all type of sound landscapes in a piece, all types of media cliches, because that's the way we are bombarded by the vortex in the environment. And I think Bob is just, he knows all these things, and he's mirroring the situation. We are in the middle of everything. And that's the idea with Wyndham Lewis. We're going to develop this tonight, later on. He said the artist is a person who can put himself in the middle of the vortex and stop it and see new patterns. Yeah.
Wow.
And this is what McLuhan called the levels of apprehension, this stopping the vortex to understand the patterns. But we are going to talk later on about all these things, and that's the what Bob has been doing, and in a way he's showing you he's in the middle of the vortex, and he's playing all these different types of music.
Yeah. Exactly. I agree. I like that statement. Okay, so let me just, I have to get the exact positioning, so I'm just going to play here a little bit, see where we're at the beginning of the session. Just a second. Okay, so what do I got to unplug? Oh, yeah, the noise guy. Okay.
Greetings, Evergreen.
All right, right there, perfect. All right, so I will now mute you two, and maybe at some point halfway through I'll stop, maybe not. If you want to say something, if you're really something really gets to you, rocks your bird, email me, you know, my private email, and I'll see your message saying, okay, can you stop? I'd like to say something. So if something comes up, email me. Otherwise, I'll just let it run through, okay? And there's a lot of different things discussed, all of it relevant. And the Zappa people that will be listening to this, they're going to have a real treat. They're going to actually hear Frank talking from the guff. or from the grave, or wherever you want to believe he is.
Okay. Yes, and I want to mention only something before you stop. This is the time of the year where everybody remembers Zappa transitioning 22 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yesterday, so December 4th.
This is like our Frank Zappa transition special.
Yes, but, he didn't die special. Frank did not die. He's still with us,
yes.
Composing with Bob. Bob, like, the only...
Like Elvis, he's just faking it. He's around somewhere.
What'd you say, Bob? Like Elvis, say Gail?
No, like Elvis, Frank is just faking it.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's somewhere around.
Yeah, he faked breaking up the mothers. He faked it. He's always faking up some disruptive rupture. And it turns out, no, he didn't do it. Okay, so Frank is here. I am the last mother invention. I'm still composing with Frank. We're in the studio. Like, remember Steve Vai says in that recording, he used to go up. He lived near Frank's home, so he'd drop over and do stuff in the studio. Well, I'm the only guy still able to drop in on Frank's studio. So I unappreciated that. All right, so we mute. Get one last giggle from you guys, then we mute. All right. Okay. And here I am, September 9th, 1997, asking the Evergreens about these issues.
This session, I'd like to talk to several people. Are those people aware that I'm and waiting to be talked to?
Yes.
Is there one particular person who'd like to speak first?
No, please begin.
All right. All right, I would like to begin with Marshall McLuhan. Can you locate him?
Yes.
Marshall, we had a conference in your name last March 21st and 22nd up at York University. What did you think of the overall performance of the speakers?
Two points on adequacy. There is some interesting progression and more of an understanding moving towards formula, but at the same time not looking at some certain practicalities, putting this at a practical point, seeing what is happening in communications as an overall, not completely realizing that a certain watershed of where communications link together, so forming a totality, that is not as understood as it is to describe various factions or fractions of communications technologies. And on the whole, it's interesting to see where it's going. And it's also interesting to see that there is good addition, good extension of proposition. On the whole, very interesting.
Yeah, for me, I had a reading, talked to you a year ago in 96, and you emphasized the fact your work was a science, not an art. The art aspect was not as significant as the science. So I interpret what you're saying now as emphasizing the science applicability of it, that, and most people haven't realized this.
Exactly.
Does Eric, your son, understand this?
He's moving towards it.
So the book, Laws of Media, the New Science, he didn't understand fully.
No, he understands it. That as a measurable state, moving towards measurement is where it must move. If you can measure individual portions of a communications totality, that only work when the portions are fractionalized, but there is less and less fractionalization, more unfractionalization of communication technologies. Where does one end and another begin? Now, certain of these would appear to be obvious, but not so. What is it moving towards? If it is moving towards a communications technology, if it is moving to a great interlinking of communications technologies, then we're moving into more measurability. It would appear that it's easier to measure a radio audience or to measure a television audience. But audiences are now more audiences than were before. And because there are now more audiences, because of greater uses of different fractions of technology, that all of these fractions move towards reassembly of themselves, as though each one is a jigsaw part that eventually becomes connected to another part, and that certain of these are invisible connections, but nonetheless, they become so much more than their antecedents. Telephone is a telephone. A cellular telephone is not a telephone. The fixedness of telephones, the unfixedness of cellular. Now, what is then the telephone? It's one technology, two technologies, a third separate technology. But you cannot have cellular telephones unless there is radio. So the combination of radio, the combination of telephone, is an entirely new methodology. It appears to be an extension of telephone, but in actuality is not, because telephone can only extend itself towards telephone. There can be better telephone. There can be intriguing telephone. There can be princess phones, but still these are phones. The cellular is not. Now, some would say that this is just an adaptation of two-way radio, more transportable, more portable because of a certain technology, but you will not have the use of this technology unless there's a need for the technology. Unless there's need, you cannot have any technology. So, what's the need? How did a society reach a certain point where it itself decided it had a need for cellular telephones? So, if you're going to measure all of this, it is measurable. Now, is need measurable? Or is the environment that is created by the communications as it is at present then that which predicts itself? Can that be measured? What comes after a cellular telephone?
All right, that's very interesting. I was wondering, in this conference, they featured Arthur Croker, who represents the postmodern strain of thinking, especially influenced by Jean Baudrillard. You were not aware of Baudrillard's writings and before when you were alive, were you?
Yes and no. Yes, but relevant.
In relative or
relevant? There's always the concept of relevancy. If you would see any description of any system and project forward where that system is going to be, you're going to make some serious mistakes. Because the projection of the system creates something that is not a projection of the system. Every communications systemology has resulted in this phenomenon. Now, his writings, frankly, miss the point.
Yes. Well, what do you think of Arthur Croker's development from Baudrillard?
The development is another thing. The development has to realize what we've just said.
Yes.
That you can project, but you're missing the point if you do not understand that the projection is into an environment created by the projection.
Yes. Let's see. So I know Eric objected to Arthur Croker's speech. He said basically it was bullshit. Marshall would agree with his son Eric on that?
Would not be as harsh, but it's a fair description.
Yeah, because... Yes?
Please.
Yeah, it's because he's still working with the idea of being art commentary, talking about relating to art worlds and art movements, and missing the science fact of it.
Yes.
Yes.
Is this concept of communication an art or a science? If it were art, then there is a different pathway. If it is a speculation about a forthcoming science, then it fits the patterns of the discussion of electricity, as well as the discussions of the concept of radio. Much could be said of the projection of an idea that, and there were movies that were done that would give pictures of 50 years hence. But all of those projections were based upon the existing system refining itself. It did not add in what it itself would create. So art can talk about art, but it cannot talk about science. Now, if communications theory is like economics, finding its rules, finding its basis, and finding that which is repeatable, that which is predictable, then the science of economics and the science of communication would equate. But neither of them are art.
I understand. I'd like to move to a retrospective question about your own work. In Explorations Number 8, the book you put out in 1957, you said that Wyndham Lewis was the first writer to treat media en bloc, E-N-B-L-O-C, French phrase, whereas Joyce and Eliot did it on a smaller scale. Now, many people now talk about the influence of Finnegan's Wake and Joyce on your writings, and they see media in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, but nobody knows about this statement or comments on the fact you're saying Lewis was the first to deal with the media en bloc. Could you clarify that phrase?
Can you understand how Lewis writes? He is not in a pattern of certain other writers. When Lewis wrote, and it would not be his light writing or his heavy writing, but the way that he wrote, it was the difference between the murmuring of a stream and the clash of a cymbal. Now, if you would see that certain writers wrote and they were almost like streams that rippled and splashed. But C.S. Lewis was a sudden clash of cymbals.
Not C.S. Lewis, Wyndham Lewis.
Wyndham Lewis,
yes.
Again.
That's what you mean.
Yes.
Clash of cymbals.
Yes. A clash of cymbals. See the difference?
Yes.
Now, Joyce was a high-pressure hose. If you look at that, you'd see that that's an en bloc. You see?
That's Joyce doing en bloc?
That is the rush of a hose. It is the symbols not as a crash, like Lewis.
Right.
But as a great sound continuing. The sound of Joyce is continuous through all of the writing. You hear it.
And it's en bloc within that style.
Yes.
So Lewis is en bloc with a clash of cymbals.
Yes.
So what did you mean that Joyce and Elliot did it on a smaller scale, medium en bloc?
Smaller is a word that can be adapted.
Yeah.
It is not smaller as in less, but as you would compare a stream trickling down a mountainside, and compare that with a high-pressure hose, and then move to the next, which would be a clash of cymbals.
I see.
That is where we would put smaller, but still that high-pressure forcedness.
Right, and Joyce took the medium block and re-amalgamated it within the verbal medium.
Yes.
Whereas Lewis just took on the media as topics in a way. He didn't aesthetically put it back into the word, the verbal medium.
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So in a sense, Lewis, as a topic, was dealt with the new media more obviously. You were talking about the BBC and that, whereas Joyce, it was a hidden agenda to refer to the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, by change, did they change the media?
You're saying both?
Take, for instance, any of Joyce's work, any, and you put that in front of a person who has not read Joyce before. And then that person reads it. How has that person changed towards the media, the print media?
He or she has changed.
Yes. Now, take a good look around you at various magazines that are available in this year, at 1997. Take a good look. Take a good look at magazines that were produced in the 20s and the 30s. Take a good look.
Yeah.
And if you take a good look, I'd like to suggest Look magazine of the 20s.
Yes.
It smashed the mold, didn't it?
Yes.
It was a visual print media.
Yes.
Now, take a good look at the Saturday Evening Post in the 20s and 30s. Take a good look. Now, move to 1997. Take a good look at Wired magazine. Take a good look at what magazines are. Take a good look, and you'll see that the whole conceptualness of the media has changed. Oh, you can still get a newspaper that looks like a newspaper, but most newspapers are not newspapers. The whole print media has changed. Take a good look, if you would, at a good copy of the Wall Street Journal in 1927-28. Take a good look at the Wall Street Journal now, this year, 1997. It has changed, but it has not changed. It has stayed an icon to itself. That is its sales appeal. It's for those who do not want Wired magazine. Now take a good look at any local newspaper in New York, or where you are at present in Toronto, and compare those with their own copies of their own antecedents of 70 years ago. What do you see? Considerable difference. Now, how did Joyce change the book form? For a moment, just look at book. What is the object of book? Obviously, when it is put with information, story, on consecutive pages, and you start at the beginning, and you read to the end, you close the covers, the book is there, a read book. It is being read. It's not unfamiliar. And people read to be changed. Book changes. But what did Joyce do to the book? Start at the beginning? Finish at the end? So, the book has changed.
Now relate that to Lewis, and since he didn't, did he do a similar change in the book meeting?
He was a contributor. A contributor. They all looked at book differently. Here's another part of book. Book is to be purchased, read, put on a shelf as a read book. That is functional book. Bring in the pocketbook. What have you got? Disposability.
Yeah.
Now, what if you write pocketbook in hardcover? Not that a hardcover would eventually become a particle, but what if you use the thinking? And then would you write differently? How would you write for the media, and how would you change the media?
So Lewis did that. He wrote pocketbook for hardcover?
Yes.
Ah, I see. I'd like to move on to another topic.
Please.
Let's see. I think I'd like to bring in James Joyce for a minute. Can we locate him?
Yes.
Mr. Joyce, why did you focus on the number 1132 in Finnegan's Wake?
Because it wasn't 1133.
Because what wasn't 1133?
1132.
Well, it's used in many different ways. The acceleration of falling object. It's used as a date, 1132 A.D. What was the symbolism of the number, if it had symbolism?
It's a continuity. It's a something that stays there and returns. And it's constantly referenced. It's something to work from, work to, work around.
Is it nothing in itself, then?
Within itself, no.
It's a medium.
It's a hook.
A hook.
And you can do so much with it. You can use it as a date. You can use it as a recipe if you want. But it's... You see... The world is abounds with figures. Do you know how many formula there are? What if there were one formula that covered everything? Well, not that it is true. And what if it could be used to relate to it? Choose any two numbers you want, or any four numbers, or ten numbers. The hazard equivalent is E equals MC squared. There's been so much crap written about that, using that as a justification, that 1132 could be used as an equal justification in as many crappy situations.
Well, I was reading an old interview with Ezra Pound, and he seemed to have worked formulaically with ABCD in the wasteland, in the cantos. Was he on the same idea?
No, that's different.
All right. So was there... reason why you wanted to make this point that you could use all these different relationships evoked by the simple four-number sequence.
Because otherwise it becomes a jumble.
Right, but you were you trying to show a portrait of how a human being's mind organizes data?
Now, if you look at everything is trying to be brought down to a simplicity that can be oftentimes ludicrous. Look at the simplicities that are given. So, the one area that does not have simplicities is various areas of formula. It can become frightening. So, therefore, why not have one formula? Why not have a set of numbers that can stand for everything?
Yes. All right, I'd like to ask a personal question. So many Joycean scholars focus on your relationship with your daughter, Lucia. Was she, her mental aberration, whatever happened, that she had to be put away quietly and not live a normal life, was that caused by some effect you had on her?
Would that it were. Then it could be examined and solved.
It had a biological cause?
It was biological. It was not caused by a relationship. It could have been improved. That's true. But if that was tried, now, would that it were a cause within the family? Quite frankly, it was caused by a dysfunctionality of the family. Very interesting. But if it were, then surely something could have been done. And do you think that nothing had been tried? This had been tried? That had been tried? None of it successful. But it's so interesting that someone after the fact, not concerned with the circumstances, can so glibly say that it was caused by the environment in which she were. Well, if that is so, would that it were, then it would have been solved.
Yes. Did you have syphilis yourself?
No.
That wasn't the cause of your blindness?
No.
And was the daughter Issy in Finnegan's Wake, your personal problems with her health, is that part of the content of Finnegan's Wake?
You read that portion.
Beg your pardon?
You read that portion.
In Finnegan's Wake?
Yes. And what did you think of it?
I don't know if I've read about that particular part about... Well, I've read about the Issy. I know her part in the book.
Read that part of the book, and you will see the exasperation. It's all well and good to write things that you can write. But not all things can be righted. There are certain illnesses that defy diagnosis, let alone treatment. And diagnosis in itself is an immature art. So why do you pay for a good doctor's work but a good doctor's diagnosis? And from that good doctor's diagnosis reach then a situation in which there can be repair. But you can only repair that which you know is broken. Well, if you do not know which part is broken, then which part do you repair?
Right. Is it true that you saw the same disease, I think, in the Gideons, Siegfried Gideon's daughter or children?
The same the sameness, but not sameness.
But you warned them, your advice to them helped them have not have the same problem?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I read that in early McLuhan writing, but no one else seems to know that story. But it's a true story?
It's a true story. You see, by then, more was known. You see?
Okay. I'd like to move on to another part of this. In your own writing, is it true to say, as Marshall says, that there is no particular personal details of any significance in Ulysses, and especially in Finnegan's Wake, that you were writing about the language and media itself and edited out yourself? Is that true?
Somewhat. But you can only see the world from your own eyes. And that is the way of seeing it. No, not all details are relevant. How a person reaches a conclusion, it's not necessarily as important as the conclusion itself. Only to other people who are interested in how conclusions are made does it become then necessary to examine it.
But you were concerned, you're saying one can only see through their own eyes. You did say that, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. You were concerned, though, in Finnegan's Wake, with issues beyond one's own eyes, but is it accurate what George Steiner said, that you were doing this complex act of writing about language as a public medium and the changes on that medium by other media?
Well, that's a very accurate description.
Yes.
But let us take a good look at fish. Do you like fish?
I have to censor the fact whether I like fish or not, so we'll just move it forward here just a second.
Someone does.
Yeah.
Another person is neither here nor there about it. Now you try this experiment. Write something that expresses all three views simultaneously.
Mm.
And where are you going to find yourself? Like, not like, fish like. You're going to have to play with the language, aren't you?
That's what you did.
Mm. You're going to have to try and put all of those three disparate views, contrary to each other, in one passage. Well, now, take another situation where you would put two like views, but not exactly like views, together. That, when we say that you can only give from your own eyes, but when you stop doing that, then, of course, personal statement disappears. You can only have personal statement if you decide to write something only through your eyes. The world is seen by me. But what if you write the world is seen by us? And rather than do it as consecutive chapters, first he talks, then the other talks. In chapter one, what Joe sees. Chapter two, what Jack sees. What if you have one chapter which is Jack, Joe sees?
All right, I understand that's what you did in the Wake. What I'm interested in is, where did you get that idea from?
Listening. Everyone has an opinion. And if you get into a bar, get into a situation where there's a few beers flowing, you're going to hear those opinions raised, voice levels raised, as these opinions are given.
But that's HCE, Here Comes Everybody.
Mm.
There's your meaning there. But why did you think it was significant to portray that?
Because chapter after chapter after chapter, is a brook meandering its way down a mountain. You know it's going to go down because gravity is going to tell it. You know it's going to go this way and that way. It's going to be through a burn here. It's going to be through a little rapid here and so on. It's inevitable. Why did it come at you with a force?
All right, did that happen? Did you see that in the newspaper medium first, or when radio and movies and telephones came in?
No. You see, they all were... They were all the same.
The media?
They were the same. Even telephones. What is this? One moment. McLuhan says that the telephone became the telephone truly when you could dial up and talk with who you chose to talk with. The first thing in the telephone was a switchboard.
Yeah.
You could have the receiver and the emitter, but you have to connect this to a switchboard. That's what made the telephone switchboard, which enabled consecutive discussion. First, this person would talk while the other listens. It was exactly the same as all the rest. If you had no switchboard, what would happen? What if everyone talked at once? Cacophony? Babel?
Well, that's what Joyce told earlier to me, that that's what Finnings Wake was, everybody talking at once.
And all of their descriptions, all of their views, all of the contra states, all of the adjoining states, no switchboard, writing four novels was a switchboard. A gavotte, a dance.
Before switchboards. What was that? Writing before switchboards?
Writing before was switchboard typewriting.
Yeah.
And it was beautifully consecutive, laid out as chapter one, act one, scene one. Exit then to scene two, three. Then it goes on.
Right, I understand.
But if you look at the Greek chorus, the playgoer went to a play where the actors on the stage were being...